like us who see the preciousness of life and the potential of life, and that every human being has the potential, the possibility of transforming their suffering, no matter how deep. That is the possibility of everyone. So, to know there are answers, and yet the person has worked themselves into a dark corner where taking their life was the only answer, that's sad. So there's nothing wrong with sadness. But there is an exaggerated sadness, which means we just get stuck in the sadness. And so in Buddhism, our empathy, our compassion, has to also involve intelligence. Intelligence meaning the capacity to understand. And in this case, we often understand, just what I said, causes and conditions. That for whatever reason, the causes and conditions of this person's life brought them to this desperate point. We're taking their own life. And again, this is not the only person to do that. Many people of all ages take their own lives, right? It's unfortunately not uncommon. And there are many, many even more people who think about it. It may not be the only possibility now, but it's one of the possibilities to their life, which means, there are many, many people who suffer, right? Suffer deep emotional pain. And there are many people who suffer deep emotional pain who may not, directly take their life, but there are many people in emotional pain who do many other things that's kind of slowly take their life. Slowly do harm to themselves. Slowly kill themselves in many ways. I mean, so here we are. And we touch this tragedy, the tragedy of the world, the tragedy of suffering. The tragedy of knowing there is another way, and yet many people seem to be on a train they can't get off. And we take that in. And what do we take that into? We take that into our heart of compassion. We take that into our aspiration, to be there for others, to be a light for others in their darkness. It's a longer term, a reason why we practice what we do and work our own transformation. So we actually know within our own body, mind, it's not just conceptual, we haven't heard it, but we actually know within our own body, mind, our own experience, that transformation of suffering is available to everyone. Because we know that, because we've transformed our own suffering. And that gives us a inner strength and our words of power that people who don't know that and they're just intellectual don't have. So this is very important. The other thing, of course, in a very practical way is, are there people that we know? I mean, this person, it's really too late. But there may be other people in our life that we know where it's not too late, but maybe sort of on that trajectory. And, something maybe can still be done, maybe not. But we should not be blind. We should be a reminder of the lonely, desperate places, the aloneness that human beings can get themselves into. So let us do anything we can to help this world. Yes.
I would like to introduce Dharma to people around me who are hypersensitive to religious dogma. What are your ideas for broaching this topic in a way to pique interest rather than scare someone away?
Yeah, so, I think, yeah, Buddhism is not evangelical, so that's really not our way. And yet, I certainly understand that. I think we, all of us who have benefited from the Dharma, from mindfulness, from meditation, from the Buddhist teachings, know that you know, we have found something very precious and something that works. And again, not saying there aren't many other, hopefully, religions, dharmas, or whatever out there that also do that. But we know what we know from our own experience. So, I mean, to, you know, when you find a good thing, you know, it's like if, if people discover a new restaurant, they want to tell all their friends, or they, you know, listen to some show or something and they want to tell other people, right? So, I mean, that energy to share is very human. But you're absolutely right. Not everyone wants to hear about it. And so, you know, to me, the best advertisement for this practice is ourselves, right? I think when family and friends, not just through words, but see us becoming different, nicer people, calmer people, more peaceful people, more stable people, less reactive, less angry, less anxious, right? I think our own individual transformation is the best advertisement for Dharma. And that hopefully, you know, people around you will notice you're changing, something's different, and may ask you, you know, what's this about? What's going on? See, when there's interest and curiosity, there's a better chance that you have a receptive audience. So that's important. To me, if you wanna talk, you know, if these are friends or family, you know, the same way when people get together, they talk about what they're up to. There's nothing wrong with you talking about what you're up to. You know, you started meditating, or you started, you know, you joined this community, or you attended this retreat or workshop. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that, right? Because that's what people tell you about their own stuff, what they've been up to. But pay attention. You know, you could probably tell very quickly whether they're interested or not, right? And so if you really get a sense they're just kind of marking time and they're not really listening, I would, you know, change the subject to something else. You know, everybody in their own time. So again, you know, the more there is interest, the more there is curiosity in other people about you, what you're into, or about the Dharma, about meditation. Yeah, I would say we should always respond. I mean, it's not like we have a secret. We want to help people. And if we've discovered something good, we're up to sharing it. But I think it's really important that, again, that we know the audience, right? And again, you want, ideally, to see some energy coming back. That's why I say, you know, you may see a few things, or, you know, are you interested in what I've kind of learned lately, or, you know, I used to, you know, have that same issue, but since I've been meditating or practicing Dharma, you know, I see it differently. Would you be interested in having me share that with you? You know, I think sort of asking those kind of questions, at least you're getting permission from the other person, you know, that they're really interested. If not, you know, that's fine, right? I mean, we're not selling anything. We don't work on commission here, so.
Please describe the appropriate balance between reading, listening to Dharma, and implementing practice on a daily basis. How much time should we spend on daily Dharma in the first year?
Daily Dharma meaning the reading or studying of Dharma as opposed to practice. Yeah. That's a good question. Again, we're on a journey that has a purpose and a meaning. The purpose and the meaning is to free ourselves, liberate ourselves from suffering, awaken all the wholesome qualities of the mind, and bring benefit to others. And to accomplish all that, you know, there are many things we do. Now, in the beginning, when we are just learning about the path, there are obviously study, reading, listening is very essential. There's a lot that can be gained from concepts and ideas. Because right now we have lots of concepts and ideas, and many of them are skewed or distorted, and they don't bring us happiness and joy and ease. So the study of Dharma is quite wonderful, and I think it's very helpful and essential. And I say that at the same time acknowledging that all of that is about our own healing and transformation. And our own healing and transformation only comes when we begin to implement what we're learning. That implementation we call practice. We're practicing something. We're practicing something in our daily life. And so, you know, there are things that we can learn, even conceptually, ideas about being more compassionate, being more understanding, seeing things as the arising of causes and conditions, seeing things as impermanent. Doing that is practicing. Okay, so we have to understand that while meditation, let's say mindfulness meditation, learning to stabilize and calm the mind is the foundation. Right? It's the foundation that we can then accomplish all these other things. So we need some degree of stability, some degree of emotional stability, some degree of concentration to facilitate our transformation. But, you know, we do not live in caves. We are lay people. You know, most of us don't live in meditation centers where we're devoting, you know, 6, 8, 10 hours a day to meditation. We are lay people. And so the important thing is, you know, what are we practicing during the day? I think I've said it before. I mean, when I first met Thich Nhat Hanh back in the 70s in France, and I was a Zen practitioner of the type, you know, that was all about meditation, you know, sitting 6, 8 hours a day, going on 7-day retreats once a month, you know, it was, you know, I thought that's what Buddhist practice and practice was about. And Thich Nhat Hanh was totally nonplussed by all that. And he'd say, you know, well, tell me about your daily life, and not just my daily life, but the daily life of people in your community, you know, are they happy? Do they have good relationships? Do they know how to love? Right? I mean, it was interesting. That was the kind of practices that he was interested in. You know, I think the other thing about if you're a beginner is, you know, it's sort of a behavioral, understanding that when one does anything and has a positive response to it, there's a good chance one will return to it. If one goes to a restaurant and we have a happy time, there's a good chance you may come back. If you go to a restaurant and it's, either very neutral or bad, there's a good chance when somebody says, you want to go here, you'll say no, or why don't we find something else? So I think what I'm saying is, I think we have to know our own limits for Dharma, for meditation. That's why when we teach concentration in our community, if your capacity for concentration and mindfulness only lasts 10 minutes, and you spend the next 20 minutes planning your day, we're really only meditating for 10 minutes. So why don't we just acknowledge that and meditate for 10 minutes? Now, what I learned in the Tibetan system of meditation is they sit 30 minutes, but in that 30 minutes, they break it up into, let's say, three 9-minute rounds where you just take a break in between. You know, it's sort of like working out or doing reps. You sort of build up. So, you know, even if like we're all sitting here for 30 minutes, even within that context, you can be aware when you've lost, you know, your concentration is waning, right? And you can just stop. I mean, nobody knows what's going on in your mind. You're safe. And you can just, you know, in your mind, just pause and relax for a moment and sort of kind of reinvigorate yourself, right? So I think it's, I guess what I'm saying in terms of the pleasure is, if our meditation is not positive to us, if it's not enjoyable, it will be harder for us to do it on a regular basis. So it's very important that our meditation, to some degree or another, you know, have a positive response within us, right? Because if it does, we will you know, there's a better chance that we will want to do it. Now, again, even saying meditation, you know, in Buddhist meditation, we talk about, you know, mindfulness, concentration, insight. So, you know, we use our meditation also, once there's a certain degree of mindfulness and concentration, to look more deeply into things. Look more deeply into the source of our anger. Look more deeply into the source of our fears. Look more deeply into the source of our unhappinesses. Not just kind of analytically or psychologically, but at a deeper level. So, you know, it is insight, it is understanding that allows us to really untie the knots that bind us, which is what we want. So, you know, and there are many meditations. I mean, you know, there are meditations in Buddhism which are analytical, where you meditate on impermanence, you meditate on dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, you meditate on non-self. You cultivate meditations for loving kindness and compassion. So, you know, I often say to people, it's very much like, you know, our meditation practice can be somewhat like, you know, when we practice music. You know, if you've ever practiced music, you know, you don't just do one thing. You see, you might do your scales, you might do some studies, you might work on some new pieces, you might work on the piece, you know, some pieces that you know, you know well, right? So it's a, can you see? So even within one meditative period, you can be developing yourself in ways. So it's interesting. Now, on the other hand, you don't want to keep jumping around. You know, it's not like you got all these practices and you sit down to do one. It's not really working. I'm kind of bored, so I'll pull out another one. You know, so it's not like that. Okay. Because we want to develop skill and we want to develop discipline and we want to develop a certain degree of stick-to-itiveness. So it's good to, you know, when you're sitting down, if you're going to sit down for 15 or 30 or 45 or an hour, you know, to sit down and to be very clear when you sit down, these are the practices I'm working on today. Right? And you know, and this is what the attention I'm going to give them. Even in terms of the question, even your Dharma study should be done with concentration and mindfulness. Right? I mean, if one is reading Dharma, and when I say reading Dharma, I don't recommend that we read Dharma like we read works of fiction, right? Where we keep turning pages. To read Dharma means we read a sentence or a few sentences or a paragraph. And then ask ourselves, what does this mean? What's being said here? Do I understand not do I understand it, but do I understand what the person, you know, do I understand these ideas that are being presented to me? You know, make sure I understand that. And then to ask yourself, how does this relate to me in my life? So that's very kind of meditative. There's concentration, there's mindfulness, and that can produce insight and understanding. So, you know, reading Dharma, I mean, it shouldn't just be, you know, just turning pages. In the same way, I think a lot of people just, you know, there's a lot of Dharma available on the internet and podcasts. And I think it's the same problem. People just listen, you know, I mean, listen while they're walking, or they listen when they're in the car. And, you know, I mean, again, it's probably better than other things, but if there's not that reflection, it's sort of in one ear and out the other. You know, it'd be better to listen to something for 10 minutes and then stop. You know, pause and really chew on it. Because if we don't reflect, if we don't think about, if we don't introspect whatever we're reading, it will not make much of a difference. So again, our study is good, but our study should lead to helping us in our own healing and transformation. Anything else, Bill?
Yes. I'm struggling to find a balance between limiting my exposure to toxic influences, news, social media, etc., while not simply withdrawing from the world. Can you speak to this issue?
Yeah, well, it's very interesting, you know, for those of us who are older than 20, I don't know. There was a time when being in the world did not mean being on your computer, your phone, social media. I mean, please understand that this idea that to be in the world is to be on social media or to be on the computer is a very recent experience for human beings. I mean, so we have to really think deeply. What does that really mean? When I'm just consuming information, which is really, I think, what goes on a lot. You know, we can just endlessly consume information. More information, more things that are going on in the world, more interpretations of it. And we think that's somehow meaningful because we're primarily learning about things that are not really relevant to our moment-to-moment real life here. The truth is, we are all in the world right now. Even though, yeah, and I realize now I'm talking to people who are viewing me through their computers or their phones. So, but, you know, we're always in the world. We are. There's no world outside of this. This is the world. We're in the world. We're part of the world. We are one of the 7 billion people whose actions, you know, create the world. So please understand that, you know, the gathering of information or seeing of images is not in the world. These are representations of the world. They're not the real world. The real world is what's right here. This is the world. Now, the question is, well, isn't it, since I do, you know, we're not isolated. I do live in a society. Things are going on. We live in a democracy. We do have the ability to vote, and we do have the ability to influence things, or, you know, there is a pandemic. It's good to know about what to do. And yeah, so obviously, you know, we don't live you know, the way people lived hundreds of years ago. Well, and many people actually still in the world live that way, but I'm talking to us. Yeah, so we do need a certain degree of information to act intelligently in this world. But my sense is it is probably for many people, it is a very small percent of the actual exposure that we're involved in every day. I think it's a question to ask yourself, you know, how much do I need to know to be, I mean, do I have to know every hour what's going on? Do I have to know every day what's going on? And if I do, oftentimes, and this is very personal. I mean, I primarily look at headlines. So I get it. The headlines are the first paragraph sort of tells you this is what's going on. If it is something that I'm involved in, if it's really something directly that I can affect, then obviously gathering more information is useful. But I think we're in a time where the medias of all types are just endlessly putting out information, nonstop. And I think we are getting addicted to it. Addiction is a kind of a stimulation. And if you keep stimulating the senses, they get used to it. They get habituated to it. And if you're not careful, like any addict, you eventually want more. Because, the 30 minutes of news doesn't give you the same buzz that it used to. And now we want 45, or now we want this, or now we want to know more. Do you understand what I'm saying? So yeah, I think this is, somebody, I haven't watched it, but somebody sent me something. I guess there's a new documentary on Netflix about social media. Does anybody? What? Yeah. That I guess really goes into this. And I guess a lot of it is about a lot of the people who invented the, have you seen it? It has what? Darker too. It's pretty good. All right. So, and anyhow, it's like alcohol and tobacco these days, they come with little things that say, just beware, this may be not good for you. And it may especially not be good for some of you. Right. And I think, all these various forms of social media and news and all that also would probably need that kind of stamp, just a warning to people. But again, this is our time, and obviously, I think it's one thing if you're an adult and older, certainly, but there's stuff coming out now just about children. And how it has to do with their own development, the development of their brain, their learning capacity, and so we're in a very new field. And usually when you're in a new field where you don't know outcomes, traditionally you're cautious, right? Like in medicine, when they introduce, it takes many years to introduce some kind of medication, right? Because it has to be tested, right? To see if it really has positive effects. And especially to see whether it has, side effects and even quite serious side effects. Unfortunately, what's going on here, there's nobody testing it. We're the guinea pigs. So, anyhow. Yeah, I think it's something very new, which has lots of consequences. And I think it really brings us back to at least what I feel is, what do I really need to be happy? Right? But, does consuming social media news make me happy? Does it make me a better citizen of this society? If the answer is yes, and a serious yes, then do what you need to do. But I think when we submit our actions and our involvements to some kind of self-awareness, we have to see that we might think, no, this is not really the case. Or it might even be, spending a lot of time here means we don't have a lot of time over here. And then we might wonder, what really, in terms of my life and what I want to do with my life, or what really gives me happiness? Sometimes when you talk to people, they said, talk about their high stress job and others, I think there are probably things that people can do, but about that. But I often ask people, well, what do you do in the evening, you see, when you come home? Or what do you do in the morning, before you go to work? And they often tell me things that are not really very nourishing for them. That old vegging out. To me, if you're in a situation that is, pressured, or there's a lot of intellectual stimulation, or, it behooves us when we come home in the evening to do the opposite. To go for walks, to be with people in a meaningful way, right? Or if you are going to, look at a screen, look at something that's really nourishing to you, to us, right? People go to work, they come home, they turn on the news, and check their social media, get into everybody's here and there. I mean, it's like, what is nourishing? And I think we have to be very careful these days, because there's a lot of stuff out there that's not very nourishing. And, I think that's very much the Dharma of Thich Nhat Hanh. Do we look at the sky? Do we look at clouds? Do we look at flowers? Do we really look at the people we live with and around and see them as human beings, see them as flowers? Or are we just kind of on a roll? Almost like we're like there's a detachment, or like a screen or a cloud between us and reality. We're up in our heads, so to speak. And many, a lot of work these days is up in our heads. And so I think the beautiful thing about Zen is that the emphasis is on direct experience in the present moment. Let's just really enjoy being together. Let me just enjoy eating this food, tasting, appreciating. Let me think about things that nourish me. I was speaking to a cousin of mine the other day, and somehow got into routines, daily routines. He said, every morning when I get up, the first thing I do is gratitude practice. So before I get out of bed, I nourish myself with gratitude. I think about all the, good things that I have in my life or that are in life. Thich Nhat Hanh, he uses that example of, we never notice our teeth until they hurt. But we don't get up every day and say, how wonderful. My teeth don't hurt today. This is great. My body doesn't ache today. This is wonderful. I can still see. I can still hear. I can still smell. I can still taste. I can still feel. How wonderful. See, that's the way to get up in the day. And then, that got to 24 brand new hours. How can I impermanence. We don't know if we're going to have another day, do we? Right? We don't know how things are going to be. Right? I mean, behind this pandemic, there could be even a worse pandemic. I hope not, but we don't know. Right? You know, I mean, we live in Florida. Those of us on the coast live in Florida, or you can live anywhere in the Gulf Coast. You know, we are hurricanes. I mean, we don't know, do we? We don't know what tomorrow is going to really be like. So, you know, today's 24 brand new hours. You know, how do I really want to use today? This precious life, this precious time. You know, and so, you know, this is the way to wake up in the morning. You know, but many people, they wake up and they have their iPhone right next to their bed, right? Or right, you know, in their bedroom. And the first thing they do when they wake up is what? You know, I mean, we need self-control. You know, we should put that phone in the kitchen or something, or put it somewhere and say, you know, I'm not going to pick it up till such and such a time. It's too easy. There's some very smart people who are making it very easy. Right? So, you know, I think the morning is very precious time. Right? And I think the evening is very precious time. And then in between, you know, when we're work or busy, obviously we want to be mindful and present and use all the activities of the day, you know, for our own healing and transformation. But, you know, we have to keep that kind of part of our life in boundaries. You know, the work day has ended. I'm going to put it down. And I'm going to nourish myself with other things. Human things. So it's a good question. Thank you. Yes, Bill.
We can see the impermanence of everything in our lives, our bodies, our family members, friends, society, and so forth. Could you talk on how taking refuge in the triple gem brings comfort to us?
That's a question. How does it, or why does it?
Yeah, could you talk on how taking refuge in the triple gem brings comfort to us?
Yeah, so again, the triple gem, for those who are not familiar with Buddhism, are this basic formula that's sort of, going back to the time of the Buddha, that's sort of an acknowledgement that one is on the Buddha's path. One takes refuge in the Buddha, one takes refuge in the Dharma, one takes refuge in the Sangha. Why does one do that? Because of what that person just said. Because of the impermanent, unpredictability, ever-changing, from the most microscopic to the largest societal. Yeah, we live in this world of impermanence, things are changing, and there is this great unknowing and uncertainty about that. That is just a given. You know, I mean, the Buddha noticed that, and we notice that. And then we also, you know, the impermanence of our bodies. You know, that we are, as soon as we're born, we are in the process of aging. And along the way, our bodies are magnets for illnesses and sicknesses and aches and pains. And that aging, you know, is not all it's cut out to be. And and eventually we're going to die. It's all going to be over. I mean, that's just one aspect, you know. I mean, and then the aspect is, you know, the way people live, and the unhappiness that people create for themselves and others. And we talked about that earlier with the suicide, and just the amount of kind of psychological suffering and unsatisfactoriness and dissatisfaction that's so omnipresent, and you know, and all that's going on in the world and societally and politically, right? Do I have to go on? No. You know, yeah, I mean, it's obvious that we would say, yeah, I need to find a place where in the midst of all this, I can have a sense of groundedness and stability and peace of mind, right? I need a place where I can learn how to be in this world with all these things that are going on and show up, you know, as an intelligent, compassionate, caring, loving, helpful, stable human being. Right? So there's a lot, you know, it is because of the conditions of the world that we think this way. Right? And that we look for that place of refuge. You know, that safe place. That's a refuge. It's a safe place. It's a nourishing place. It's a restorative place. That's a refuge. That's a true refuge. So, you know, what in Buddhism we call that, you know, our refuge is the Buddha Dharma Sangha. We take refuge in the great teachers that have shown us the way in this life. We take refuge in them, in their experience, in their awakenings. We take refuge in their words, in their teachings, in their practices that they've taught us. That's the Dharma. And we take refuge in the community, the people of who are practicing with us, the practice who practice the Buddhist Dharma, the way of awakening and love. And so now we have some support. Now we have we have a refuge, and to me that's essential these days, especially these days. So the condition of the world, the condition of human beings, is directly related to why one would seek refuge. Okay. Other questions? Anybody in the hall? Yes. Oh, nothing? Oh, okay. We can just sit here. So if anybody has any questions about life, practice, meditation, I'm here. I'm totally open. It can be anything. But if not, you know, I could share something. So let's just give it another moment. Yes.
I had a friend that during the pandemic went through a sort of psychological break.
So let me just repeat that. So she has a friend, and during the course of the pandemic has really sort of had a psychological break, which means... Oh, so she's really having a psychiatric moment there. You're saying she's sort of not in reality anymore. Okay. Yeah. So the question is, so this person has been reaching out, trying to help her. Coming back into reality and dealing with it, and she doesn't think.
She had explanations for why it's happening.
Yeah, yeah. She's all right. So this, she has reasons and explanations for her delusions, and believes they are real.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So the question is, what can you do? And then that's it's sort of like we talked a little earlier. It's, you know, that was a question about, you know, sharing the Dharma. This is different. But yeah, I mean, we need, if we're going to help somebody, we need have somebody who wants to be helped. If somebody doesn't want to be helped, like this woman, right, who believes whatever craziness she believes in. And we're all like that. You know, we can all look back on our life and go, yeah, there were times when it was, you know, now that I look back, or to anybody, yeah, I was really messed up. Or I was really deluded, or I was really not seeing clearly. But at the time, we thought what? Right. So the only difference with this woman is that she's further out that spectrum. You know, I mean, she's more delusional. right? It's very clear to everyone, that she's not grounded in reality. So she needs help, professional help. I appreciate that you've been, trying to be there for her, but, at a certain point you realize, yeah, this is beyond me, right? Yeah, so, that's where you, see if she'll go to seek professional help. Yeah. Right. Right. She's an adult. And as you know, for all of us, we can be as crazy as we want, but as long as we somehow keep it somewhat within societal norms, we could even be president that's right. So we need to thinking of the first question about suicide. That's really the only danger, if at any point in you're checking in with this woman, you feel, she is so deluded that she is going to hurt herself. And you know what I'm saying? At that point, then some stronger intervention to prevent that, would be needed. She's a very sick woman. It'd be nice if, I used to be a mental health professional, It used to be sort of anybody could, incarcerate people, who were delusional, based, physician, a relative, anybody could. Now, people with psychiatric disturbances have rights, right? And so unless they're really at a point of doing danger to themselves or others, they have a right to be who they are. So, that's just... Yeah. So, that's a point of practice. Yeah. So what's being shared now is the personal side, which is, this is not easy, right? To realize, and this is something we all know. We all have friends or family. We've all been here. There are people who we see very, in our eyes at least, are clearly suffering, right? Are clearly doing things that are harmful to themselves or others, right? And we can't stop it, can we? And that's whether it's very personal and close or whether it's societal, right? There are things that are going on that are, things are in play and, our ability to affect things are very limited. There may be areas of our lives, where we can make a difference, but that other truth is truth too. And that's really, I think, very important for us. This is where the understanding of causes and conditions, which is so central to the Buddhist path, part of our understanding, that everything is happening because of causes and conditions. And that the motion of the causes and conditions is not the last cause and condition. The last cause and conditions were there because of prior causes and conditions, as well as there are many primary and secondary causes and conditions that are supporting this unfolding, right? And that's just the way it is. That's the way everything is. That's the way I am. I have to, we have to learn, would you rather, have you ever thought, gee, I really would like to really change myself? And having made that statement, can you immediately do it? No. Here it is, even in our own life. Right? I'd like to sit down in meditation and not have any thoughts or only have wonderful, benign, loving, intelligent thoughts, right? And yet, what's the truth? Our mind has its own mind. Right? And you know, we can certainly, through our practice, relate to that. But as it really goes back to what, you know, where we started in our meditation this morning, which was, you know, we're not here to stop our thoughts. We can't. Right? We're here to learn how to intelligently and wisely deal with them so we can transform them. And that's why I'm a true believer that we learn on the mat, on the cushion, how to live. You know, because that is a fundamental truth. When anybody who crosses their legs or sits down to meditate, you realize my mind is totally out of control. Right? You know? And rather than struggling with it or fighting with it, you know, I'm trying to change it. And one way I change it, I relate to it differently. I relate to it intelligently. Right? And so if one learns to deal with one's own conditioning, right? Accept it with understanding and compassion, and learn, you know, that the process of change and transformation takes time, right? And one of the biggest things that is needed for change and transformation is a person who wants to change and transform, right? Right? I mean, there may be many people on this talk today who, you know, can look back and go, yeah, I had lots of issues in my life, right? But what? I wasn't ready to change, really, was I? I wasn't really ready to stop, look deeply, and go, yeah, I need to find another way. You know, we just kind of messed around, or we just picked another dysfunctional way to respond to life, right? So we should have some humility. See, that should humble us, because we see in the face of our own dysfunction, in the face of our own emotional afflictions, it has not been that easy to change, right? I mean, we have often received good advice from people along the way, and we totally what? Ignored it or dismissed it or thought we knew better. I mean, and then we get so upset when other people do that to us, you know, I mean. So again, this is a willingness to act intelligently in life and to know, you know. It's like when the person was asking about, well, how do you share the Dharma? Well, you know, the first thing you do is make sure that there's a person who's interested in what you have to say. If the person isn't interested or is not ready, you know, one, you're wasting your time, right? Two, you may be creating a negative situation by always pushing it, right? So why do it? Why don't you step back and think, you know, this person as they are, how can I help them? I mean, sometimes with people, it's, you know, how do you create a safe container so they don't do harm? You know, that's all we can do, right? You know, it's like with children, you know, a parent sets up a safe environment. Why does a parent set up a safe environment for the child? What? So they don't hurt themselves, right? Because, you know, they're not there yet where they can function on their own without hurting themselves. So we set up an environment that is safe, that has boundaries, right? I mean, so this is the same thing. I mean, you know, just because people are 20 or 30 or 40 or 50, they still might have that same problem, right? And so oftentimes we have to kind of set up a safe environment or create boundaries because the person themselves, you know, just isn't able to yet. And that's part of our compassion. Our compassion of ending their suffering is not that they have to end their suffering the way I want them to end their suffering or how I think they should end their suffering, right? In Buddhism, in relationship to compassion, our key paradigms are appropriateness and skillfulness in all our interventions to help people. Appropriateness means I understand who the person is. I understand where they're at. I understand their causes and conditions. I understand their culture, you know, and all those things. So my interventions are appropriate to them, not to me. See, many of our interventions are just appropriate to me. This is what I think should be done. But the first thing we should look at, who is this person and what kind of intervention or non-intervention would be appropriate to them? That's number one, right? Two is skillfulness. So we could kind of get the situation and still, you know, what would be a skillful way of intervening, of talking, suggesting? And that's kind of that's the art of it. That's the creativity of it, because there's no one answer. So skillfulness, which in Buddhism is called upaya, goes back to the Buddha. You know, if you read the Buddha's teachings, and you know, he taught for nearly 50 years, so it's quite voluminous. And a lot of his teaching was in relation to people asking questions. And you often see he taught over here with one thing, and then something very different over there, you know, seemingly the same question. Well, what's the difference? The Buddha said, I teach, you know, according to appropriateness and skillfulness. So, you know, having the understanding of who this person is, he gives an answer that would be helpful to that person where they're at. Somebody over here may be in a totally different place, so you might give a totally different answer. Right? You know, again, you know, when your child is 5 and asks you a question or does something, you may give them one answer. When they're 10 or 15 and they're giving the same answer, you may give a totally different response, right? Because they're different. They have more skills, they have more, you know, they could be functioning differently, right? So it's sort of this developmental understanding of human beings are very important. I mean, in Buddhism, we have this whole idea of what we call the 6 realms, you know, which are really psychological. They're really understanding that people are like in their own realm. Some people are in the animal realm. They're just very basic. They don't have a lot of intelligence. They don't have any real self-awareness. You know, they're not that they're bad. I'm not saying that. This is not a good bad. This is just where people are at, you know. Animals in the best sense, you know, it's not like they're animalistic, you know. They're just, you know, they don't have any kind of intelligence or self-reflection, or they don't have an inner life at all. You know, they just go through their life, right? You know, some people like hungry ghosts. They're just endlessly needy, 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 never filled, always dissatisfied. Some people in the realm of anger, they burn with anger, you know. Some people are in despair. I mean, there are all kinds of realms of people. Some people are in high realms, you know. I mean, like if you look at our people who run our country, many of them are what? In Buddhism, we call them titans. They care about only one thing, power. Power over. You know, they love the fight. They live for the fight. They live to compete. They love to win. They don't like to lose. You know, in Buddhism, that's called the titan mindset. Some people are like devas. All they care about is what? Luxury, sensuality, and everything is beautiful, you know, and as well as they want to be famous, celebrities, you know, I mean, and you look at the world and go, oh, I get it. Yeah. You know, these people are in the deva realm. These people are in the titan realm. These people are in the hungry ghost realm. These people are in the animal realm. That's where they are. Right? You know, try reading a book to your dog or cat. People in the hall are laughing. Why do you laugh? Because they're not there, right? I mean, it's, right? They're not there. Right? I mean, that would be inappropriate, right? Wouldn't it? Yeah. I mean, they like dog treats, don't they? You know, I mean, try reasoning with your dog about right and wrong. They don't understand right and wrong, but they understand dog treats. So that's the way you deal with, and we have to understand human beings are like that. Some people you can talk with. Some people you can, you know, have intelligent conversations. Some people are capable of insight. Some people aren't. And we have to understand that because we live in a world, and again, in Buddhism, I mean, the human realm is very mixed. So in a certain sense, these six realms are all in us. All of us have parts of that within us. But actually the six realms, I think, is a very useful way of looking at things because it gives you understanding. Oh, that's what they live for. You know, they live to be noticed. They live to be beautiful. You know, they live for luxury. I mean, that's their life, right? I mean, that's what it's all about for them. Oh. And again, each of us may have a piece like that. Anyhow. Well, thank you all. Hopefully this was beneficial. This discussion we had this morning, again, actually, as I said before, this is actually the way the Buddha did much of his teaching. He just kind of wandered around Northern India with his students and disciples, and he would come to a town and village, and they would live outside the village, and they would go into the village to beg because they didn't carry food with them, and then the people would come out to see the Buddha and ask him questions, and he would respond. So this is a very alive way. Thank you, everyone.